right, Esther chapter 2. That's where we are today. And I'll kind of keep it short tonight, keep it kind of deal section by section, as it were. And today we get introduced to Esther and Mordecai for the first time. Esther chapter 2, we'll read the first 11 verses. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had, what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital, under custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is, Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in the custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken in the king's palace and put in custody of Hegai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day, Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. All right, a little bit of background. You might say it's better to call this review. Now you may remember we talked last week that the story of Esther started as chapter 1, verse 3 mentioned, in the third year of his reign. That's when the whole book starts. Now, he became king in approximately 486 B.C., right? The story of Esther, the book of Esther, starts in approximately 483 B.C., third year. And there's accounts that he had this great war council, where he's essentially trying to garner support, gather his people, so that he can plan a major, massive campaign against Greece. Now, from here, we can try to deduce about what the time frame is. Not by it so far, but really what comes after. Because in chapter 2, we just know after these things, when the king, his anger abated. Well, it doesn't say much after those days. But we can kind of work backwards from what's coming ahead. If you look down, even though we're not really looking at this today, look down at verses 16 and 17 of chapter 2. "And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." So we see that Esther became queen in his 7th year. So that's approximately 479 B.C. Just working from the 486 when he became king, 7 years later, give or take, depending on how they counted the years and days and so forth. But approximately 479. That means that Esther entered the city of Susa. Well, it seems that she lived there anyway. But entered into the king's harem, the palace for the harem, 1 year prior to that. Now, how do I know it was 1 year prior? Yeah, the treatments. All the beauty treatments. Wouldn't it be nice to be pampered for 1 year?
A spa for a year.
You know, it gets to be a little overkill, I would think. I don't know where they came up with the whole 6 months of this and 6 months of that. Let's see, where is it? 6 months of... Yeah, the 6 months of, like, oils, and then 6 months of... What's that?
Verse 12,
yeah. 6 months of oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women. That's a lot. You know, if you get 6 minutes, you know, quick pedicure, I hear the ladies like that. I don't know. That's fine. Nobody's going near my feet. That's all I can say. But really, I mean, so now we've backed this up. Approximately 480 B.C. is when this edict came about. So there we have it. That's roughly the time frame, approximately his sixth year into his reign. Now, one thing to note. In chapter 1, there were 16 individuals mentioned by name that were on the scene. The king, Ahasuerus, Vashti, and then you had 7 nobles and 7 eunuchs. Of those 16, only one remains on the scene in chapter 2. Now, 2 are technically mentioned, but only one is on the scene because the second one is just a memory. Only Ahasuerus. So all those other people, they don't matter really anymore. Now we've got just simply the king. So, notice how this is worded. When the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. This is kind of interesting because this is some 3 years later. Now, the readers, the original readers, would have probably known that. You know, we're a couple thousand years removed from this, so we think, you know, after these things, well, not too long later. Well, this was 3 years later. And it was 3 years later, and Ahasuerus did make his campaign against Greece, and he pretty much failed miserably. Embarrassed, defeated, the Macedonians and Greeks, they took him on, and he lost. Mark?
Was that where that Molinave came from, the 300? There's a bunch of Greeks who are defending.
Well, that could be. I don't know.
Is that when that happened?
It might be. But basically, there was about a century before the onset of Alexander the Great where the Persians and the Greeks kind of back and forth for a while. That's a rough estimate, but yeah. And really, it was Alexander the Great that ultimately pushed out the Persians. He was the one that came in and just swept it all out. We've got this timing, and you know, it's kind of interesting. I just wonder why 3 years later, all of a sudden, he's thinking about Queen Vashti. I don't know. There's really no answer to that. But he's coming back. He's embarrassed. And reports have it, at least from Herodotus, one of the main Greek historians, is that he basically came back and comforted himself with all kinds of extravagant self-indulgence. You thought the wine flowed in chapter 1? Well, the wine flowed plenty after this. And any imaginable hedonistic way in which one could seek self-gratification, he did it. We'll just leave it at that. All right? But in the midst of this, he thinks of Queen Vashti. well, she's no longer queen. Remember that after she was deposed, she was never mentioned as queen again. Trish, did you have a comment or question? Celebrity, yeah. A lot of celebrities tend to have this kind of narcissistic attitude, yep. So, but it, the way the story is presented, it's almost as if, well, you know, after this, then, even though it was 3 years later. So he remembers the queen, remembers Vashti, what she had done and what he had decreed against her. And it doesn't make her make him angry. There's almost, it seems, with the direction of how things now proceed, there's a sense of loss there on his part. Now, it's interesting because next in verse 2, then the king's young men who attended him said, and they come up with this grandiose plan. Now, unlike before, in chapter 1, where the king went and sought his nobles to find out what should be done, that's not explicitly told here. And it seems that the author is just simply intending for us to understand that's probably what happened. He didn't know what to do, so he sought others' advice, and they told him what to do. And so you've got, once again, the king pictured, an individual who has absolute power in his empire, not knowing what to do, and having to be told what to do. It's kind of pathetic if you think about it. That's how he's being presented. So the king's anger abates. They know about this. The king's campaign is a failure. A serious spree of self-indulgence. He comes home in defeat. And then he remembers Vashti. And now we get to verse 2 through 4. And this is the king's young men. They have a plan. And they're described as young men. It's not kind of the same as those guys who were in the first chapter. You know, the first chapter, you have these seven princes and nobles, as they're called, and some of the historians indicate that these seven guys had immediate and uninvited access into the king's court. Well, here we've just got young men. There's no other description about them, but they come up with this plan, and you see in verses 2 through 4, the king's young men who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital, under custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. You know, the author here leaves much to the imagination, doesn't he? What's the motivation here of the young men? It's really a hypothetical question. I'm not really looking for an answer. What's their motivation? I mean, really? There doesn't seem to be anything here except that, you know, maybe they're young men and they just want to see all the lovely ladies too. It's really difficult to say what's going on here as to why they need this plan. Because it's apparent he's already got a harem. So there's some kind of manipulation going on here, but that's just not totally spelled out. And really, throughout much of the book, you see this constant manipulation of some kind on the king by various individuals. And so you see this little subtle thing without much of a reason given. The king's being manipulated to set this edict and do something to comfort himself. Find a new queen. Trish?
In the previous chapter, he had set himself up because Vashti's never again to come before him and let the king give her royal position to know that he was better than she.
So right.
If she was beautiful, he'd have to go find someone better than she.
Yeah, and
it's
time for the next Miss America, right? Yeah, and it is interesting because that decree is subtle. It does say to find one better than she. Well, he never did it. Now he's stuck. He doesn't have one. And, you know, the language that's given here, it's looking like he needs to be comforted. At least that's his own opinion of himself. But, it gets a little bit confusing because he lived this lifestyle of complete self-indulgence, but you see that he's still not comforted. Yeah, he could be. Yeah. He's got to replace her, but why didn't he think of this? I mean, it's everybody else who has to point all these things out to him. And why go about it this way? You know, it's just a bizarre kind of way of doing it. Even if the king did remember, why go about it this way? He already had a castle full of women, but let's try this and bring some more in.
Do any of the historians say, did the harem accomplish anything besides pleasing the king?
Not much.
Because when David is deposed by Absalom, he leaves some of his harem to take care of the palace.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if they did that sort of thing.
That could be, but one thing it does seem is that, and as I'll put this somewhat mildly and euphemistically, there were actually two palaces. One before they would visit the king, and then they would go to the after palace, and they would just stay there, and that was it. And there does not seem to be any indication, unless it so happened that the king called for somebody by name, but it seemed in this case with the Persians that he had those two separate homes, palaces, before and after, to put it euphemistically. There doesn't appear to be any other indication beyond that.
It would be a status thing to have a huge harem.
Oh, absolutely.
And he had the money to support them.
Sure.
You know, even though he lost to the Greeks, probably lost a fortune to
it. Yeah, no doubt.
But still, it kind of makes you wonder, why does he need so many more?
Yeah.
Surely he got hundreds more in this deal.
Mm-hmm. No doubt, especially since the decree is to go out to all the provinces. Well, remember chapter 1 said there's 127 provinces. And that's it. That's a good point. She must have been stunning and amazing. Right. What's that? And he knew it.
That's why I wanted to show her off in the first place.
Yeah.
Everyone else had gotten 3 years older.
Yeah, everybody else, they're older. That's it. That's got to be it. You know, 3 years, I mean, come on.
1 hour of 22.
So.
Well, besides probably having some regular turnover and the distinction, but there was also behind, I don't know as much, the women in the harem, I know the wives that these men took on had political connotations.
Right. Oftentimes, yes.
Were often formed. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if women in these harems had the same relationship where they came from. So a lot of it was to develop treaties and relationships between the king and these other areas.
That was very common. I mean, all of the various empires, you see that even in Israel's history itself with the various kings. I mean, that's what Solomon did.
All the way up to modern England.
Yeah, in modern England. That's still going on. But it just seems odd that, it almost seems that he's trying to create this trophy queen apart from anything else. And that seems to be the accomplishment here. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. And so that sets the stage. Verse 5, then we shift. We get this parenthetical description from verse 5 to verse 7. It's sort of an aside. Oh, and by the way, here's Mordecai. Mordecai. Now, notice his background. There was a Jew in Susa, so we know, despite the fact that the king's bringing all these women from all over the empire, from all the provinces, his queen was right there already. He just didn't know it yet. So Mordecai is a Jew living in Susa, the citadel. That's his name. He's the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite. Now this is where it gets difficult. is Kish referring to a great grandfather, or is Kish referring to a famous Kish in Israel's history?
Saul's father.
Saul's father. Remember King Saul? King Saul was the son of Kish and a Benjamite. So you have this thing that's starting to be set up here, little by little, and the original readers to the story would have known these connections. Now, there are some, the grammar here in the structure from verse 5 to verse 6 is technically a little bit tricky, but it's not that hard. The son of Kish, a Benjamite who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah and so forth. There are some critics who look at that and say, you know, who had been carried away, and they make Mordecai the antecedent to that, that it's speaking of Mordecai there who was pulled away. And they say, well, if that was the case, Mordecai would be over 100 years old here, which, well, that's true. But the grammar also fits that it could be this Kish person, or even Shimei, or even Jair, who could have been the one that was taken. So Mordecai, a Jew living in Susa, was probably born there. But the key here, and this is the key that we need to remember throughout this story, is that not only was he a Jew, but that he was a Benjamite. And that is going to be a key factor in his conflict with Haman. And we'll see as we get introduced to Haman, really in chapter 3, we'll see where that conflict comes in the history of the tribe of Benjamin in particular, and then also Haman's background in that. So Mordecai is introduced. And the interesting thing about this is in 1904, an inscription on a tablet discovered in another Persian royal city. You may remember there were four different royal cities of the Persian Empire. Susa was one of them. While another city, a tablet was uncovered that had the name Mordecai, who was declared or described as an official of the Persian Empire in the royal city. And so while the name itself, Mordecai, was somewhat common, that is a really strange, shall we say, coincidence. It really fits. And so you have this description on an ancient tablet found in another Persian royal city describing this individual named Mordecai, who served as a close Persian official to the king. I think the book of Esther is true. What do you think? Now, that alone doesn't prove it. It's just one of those things to say to the critics, see, I told you so. Now, is that definitive? Well, not necessarily, but, you know, that's awfully close. Awfully, awfully close for it to not be true. So, that's not the only thing we know about Mordecai. We get down to verse 7. He was bringing up Hadassah. What does Hadassah mean? Who remembers?
Myrtle.
Hadassah, his niece, for all practical purposes, or cousin. It's the daughter of his uncle, so the description there makes it a cousin. So, he's got to be older, because he takes her as his own daughter, as the rest of verse 7 indicates. But Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Now, even the ESV, it kind of sounds almost half crude the way she's described. But literally, well, the ESV has it this way, that she was beautiful, had a beautiful figure, and that she was lovely to look at. The Hebrew is somewhat literal like this. I've got it written down here, or typed out, I should say. Yeah, here's her description. The young woman was beautiful of form, and good or pleasant of appearance. That's kind of a literal translation of it. Beautiful of form and good or pleasant of appearance. So that's kind of the description that's given to her. Now, it's significant there because in Hebrew narrative, when somebody's description is given, it usually is going to play a role in the story of that individual. For instance, Absalom. Remember Absalom, King David's son? There is an interesting description about him. And what was that? Anybody remember?
His hair.
His hair. His hair, and he had like all, they weighed so much, and he had to brush it all out. That's described in 2 Samuel chapter 14, and you think, oh, give me a break, this guy with his hair. But how did Absalom die?
He got stuck in a tree.
His head got stuck in a tree, and he was left hanging there. And the image is that it was his hair that got him stuck there. And as a result, Joab came along and killed him. So you see, there's an example like that. And then you also think of Samson. Now, Samson was told that he was not to cut his hair. Now, hair, it was just a coincidence that I'm talking about hair here. But Samson was told not to cut his hair. That was a significant key thing, being a Nazarite. And because he did, he lost his strength, and that played into the story. And there are other similar examples to this as well. But that means then that Esther's description of being beautiful in appearance, pleasant in appearance, is going to have a role in this story. Now, some rabbis and some Targums and commentaries of ancient Jewish literature describe Esther as one of the four most beautiful women of all time. Anybody want to guess what these Jews also picked for other of the most beautiful women? Do you know? Nope, not even that. Rahab was one of them, interestingly enough. I thought that was fascinating. I believe Bathsheba was one of them. And there was one more, and unfortunately, Abigail. David's wife, the fool's wife. And then David took her as wife. So you have these four and then Esther. And so this plays a huge and significant role in the story. So Vashti was something to look at. So was Esther. Michelle?
I think there's a little play on the senses.
Mm-hmm.
He's weak in his eyes.
Yeah.
He's weak in his mouth. He needs alcoholic beverage. He's weak in his ears. He needs to be told. He's weak in his nose. He has to be tested. I mean, it's just portraying a very weak, malleable.
Yeah. Very much. Very fickle individual who has the throne but doesn't have the throne.
Mommy.
And so you have Esther, and by the way, the name Hadassah, this is the only place in the Old Testament that this name occurs. In that one spot, right there, in verse 7, you don't see this name anywhere else. But she's called Esther. Now, Esther could mean a couple of possibilities. It could just simply mean the Persian for star. That's a possibility. Or it could just be a, kind of a Hebrew way of saying Ishtar. Now, does anybody know who or what Ishtar was? Besides a really bad movie in the 80s.
Isn't that the god of the Ephesians?
Yeah, related to that. A Babylonian god, goddess, of love and war. That's kind of interesting because you've got her beauty. One evening with the king, and she becomes queen, goddess of love. When Haman's plan is exposed in chapter 9, it is Esther who asks for a second day of killings against the enemies of the Jews. It is Esther who asks for the sons of Haman and Haman himself to be hung up on the gallows, even though they were already dead. Asked to be hung up on the gallows for all to see. Goddess of war. And so the author, whether or not Esther was truly her name, and it could have been, because we know that people did have two names back then, it wasn't uncommon. At the very least, this name for Esther is labeled there to really get us to think about her role in the history of Israel. With no judgment whatsoever passed on her actions, her thought life, or anything like that. Compare some of the things that she had to go through here just in the verses we're looking at. Verse 8, so when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in the custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken to the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with seven chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young woman to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now, there are some interesting comparisons here, or more accurately, some contrasts. Typically, we see so many Old Testament examples in the situation of being with Gentiles that they would stand true to who they were. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. No. Don't give us this unclean food. Put us to the test. We don't have that with Esther, do we? She takes the king's portion of food and everything else. It seems, at least on the surface, there's no indication that she had any problem with associating herself as being just another Gentile. And yet there's no judgment passed on her. You notice that? It's just simply told as a fact. And there's no judgment, no description, positive or negative, as to her actions. Trish?
She was obeying Mordecai.
But that has to bring the next question. Why was Mordecai hiding this fact? He wasn't being a good Jew here. Now, you could, like you said, you could argue that she was just simply obeying Mordecai. True. Okay. But what about Mordecai? Allowing this to go through this way. Allowing his charge, his cousin, whom he's essentially adopted as his daughter, to go and join the king's harem and to participate in all of the ritual preparations, including the unclean foods. And yet there's no judgment passed on either of them by the author. Isn't that interesting?
The author seems to suggest they have to hide her nationality.
Well, that could be, that's another question. Why? You have Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego with the Babylonians. They stood their ground. Throw us in the furnace. The Lord can rescue us. And even if he does not, we will not bow down. That was their response to Nebuchadnezzar.
Didn't Daniel serve all the way up to Xerxes' father?
Yeah, up to Darius. And same kind of thing. The decree went out that only are to pray, I think it was for 30 days, to pray only to Darius. Well, three times a day, as was his practice. He went out there and prayed in the open. He had no problems being who he was. But here Mordecai does this. Esther goes along with it. But there's no inkling of a negative light put upon them for doing this. Nor is there anything positive said either. It's just presented as fact. And throughout the book of Esther, Mordecai and Esther in particular are presented simply as morally neutral. And that's an interesting thing to think about that. They're just simply presented as morally neutral individuals being carried along. And that's actually another point. What do we have here? In the middle of verse 8, Esther also was taken. Now, for you English nerds and grammar nerds, that's kind of a passive voice. And a passive voice, what that means is that the person who is the subject of the sentence is the recipient of the action. So an active voice would be something like this, a very simple sentence. I hit the ball. I'm the one doing the action. That's an active voice. A passive voice would be, I would kind of turn that around. I was hit by the ball. I'm the subject of the sentence, but I'm receiving the action. I'm not doing anything. It's just happening to me. Much of the verbiage in the book of Esther, especially as it relates to Esther, is written in the passive voice. Things are being done to her. But it's not so much later on that things turn, and we'll see. It becomes a point when Mordecai goes to Esther and then says what's going on, uncovers Haman's plot, that then she starts to take charge of everything, and Mordecai fades into the background. So there's a lot of little interesting changes of events that take place. How, in one sense, Esther is just passive all the way through until Mordecai comes and uncovers the plot to her. And even then, she's kind of hesitant. We'll get to that. But it does come about. But notice that she also seems to catch the eye of the king's eunuch here. And there we have a parallel to Joseph. Joseph, when he was sold into slavery, goes into Potiphar's house. And Potiphar was able to just leave him there. Now, Potiphar's wife had other plans, and that didn't go so well for him. But then he goes to jail. And even in jail, he wins the favor of the jailer. And he's put in charge of pretty much everything. So, got some interesting parallels in the history of Israel compared to Esther. So every day also, Mordecai walks in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what happened to her. Every day. Isn't that nice? Every day. For a year. You think about this. This is a year. Every day for a year, he goes and checks on Esther. So, Trish? Yeah.
It doesn't
sound like
something you just
Right. Yeah, it certainly could have been against the will, but it. And that's where the comparison to Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. Joseph didn't have a choice. He was put in the chains and so forth. That could be. But at the same time, you know, he didn't stand his ground. She, you know, why hide? And I think ultimately the reason why he was hiding his Jewishness, if I can put it that way, is because he knew already of the anti-Semitism that was going on in the court. Because when Haman learns that he's a Jew, Haman's not satisfied to just simply kill Mordecai. He wants to kill them all. I mean, Haman was a bit crazy. He wasn't stupid, but he was crazy. And all he had to do was find out Mordecai was a Jew, and that was it. It set him off. He wanted to kill them all. So I do think Mordecai was aware of that, and so that's why hide your Jewishness. So, hide the fact that you're a Jew. That's really the only plausible explanation. So, Norm?
Couldn't the devil be in on the whole plan of Haman, knowing that the promised one was going to come through the Jews, so if he could wipe them all out, that would get rid of that.
That certainly could be. I think really at the forefront of the author's mind is not so much what Satan's doing in the background, it's what God is doing in the background. Despite all the passiveness that the Israelites seem to be in, he's controlling the whole thing. God is, that is. And it's in his providence that 3 years later, the king just happens to remember Vashti. Mordecai, a Jew, just happened to be living there in Susa with his cousin, adopted daughter, who happens to herself be beautiful. And so one thing on top of the other, you know, without God and without understanding his providence, you look at this and the story seems a little bit beyond belief. There's just one coincidence, if you will, after another. And yet, the Lord is in control. So, next week, we move into the depth of chapter 2, where she actually becomes the queen. And other things happen there as well. But really, once we get into chapter 3, we're going to be introduced to Haman.
Well, once again, this eunuch, Haggai, he puts Esther in the best place.
That's right.
There are levels, I guess, in this harem. And again, it's God's providence, mm-hmm. isn't it, that she's just moved to where she'll be noticed.
Yeah. And it's interesting because since she's not the only one there, the king still could have passed by her, even though Haggai put her up top, as it were. The king could have just passed by. And everything, you see, the way the story is being told, it's being set up, as you said, in such a way that in every stage she's being exalted, as it were, in preparation for the king to pick her. So. Trish.
There should be something said about her obedience to Mordecai, because that would create another view.
Yeah, there's certainly an obedience there, and that's where the tension comes. She's noble because she kept obedient to Mordecai. But in another sense, she's not being obedient to God. She's not obeying God's law here.
Maybe she was never instructed in God's law.
That could be too. We don't, and that's the interesting thing. You read through the book of Esther, it's not presented to us that they believed and called on the name of the Lord. Because God's name's not even mentioned. And that's that little ambiguity there that you sit there, you scratch your head, and you realize this is beyond just merely Esther and Mordecai. This is God who is directing all things.
Isn't it true that the Jewish people view the tribe of Benjamin as like the lower tribe?
Well, they considered themselves that to a degree. I mean, even Saul, when he became king, I'm a part of the least tribe. And even Paul said something similar.
Yeah, and the incidents in Judges really make Benjamin look bad.
Yeah.
And Judah look good.
Right.
David's.
Yeah, the last very end of the book of Judges really puts the tribe of Benjamin in a bad light and the tribe of Judah in a very good light. Tribe of Benjamin, they're the ones that, you know, as a result, Levi cuts up his concubine and sends it to the 12 corners. And the Benjamites and, you know, the rest of the Israelites come and try to wipe them out, but save for a few hundred, really only a few hundred, the Benjamites were mostly wiped out. And that's why they really were the weakest tribe by the time Saul came on the scene. So, Bible doesn't hide the gruesomeness and the sinfulness of man, does it?
That's not too unusual for Hebrew history not to moralize.
Yeah.
Not to pass judgment. A lot of the historical books are written very much this way. Even Genesis itself.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't see the judgment passed on what these patriarchs are doing.
Yeah.
Many times. And it continues that way through a lot of it. When you compare Kings and Chronicles, one of them does give some judgment when the other doesn't.
Right.
And so on. But an awful lot of the history is just passed as history.
Yeah, the patriarchs in particular. There's Joseph is one who's never presented as being sinful. Even the patriarchs where they mess up, you know, Jacob and his conniving.
Abraham and Isaac
with
lack of faith.
Yeah, passing off their wives as their sister.
Yeah.
Abraham did it twice, and Isaac did it himself. And know, interesting, because those particular stories, like you said, there's no judgment passed. God judges the king who took him, took the wife, but never really says anything to Abraham. So, all right, any other thoughts or comments on Esther? We're introduced to her, Mordecai. Next week, we'll start looking into really when she becomes queen and the events subsequent to that. So.